This is Professor Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, Barrister at Law, and our subject is Marxism and Human Rights. Marxism and Human Rights. Now you say, there aren't a lot of Marxists left. This is analogous to dealing with dinosaurs. They may be of interest historically, but they don't have a lot of relevance at the moment. Well, true enough, outside of China and Cuba, you don't have a lot of Marxists. Perhaps we ought to add a few Neanderthals in English law faculties, but in general, the impact of Marxism is immensely less than it was even a decade ago. After the disappearance of the Marxist philosophy as the prevailing philosophy in the USSR and the satellite countries, that viewpoint has certainly not had the political impact that it had previously. But the Marxist philosophy of human rights has been one of the most influential legal philosophies of this century, and it continues to impact under other names. Sometimes it's called the socialist philosophy of human rights. Sometimes it reappears in the views of people like Antonio Gramsci, the famous Italian Marxist who has influenced radical positions that would not themselves use the term Marxism. It's important for us to see how the Marxists attempted to justify human rights, because we can learn something, at least by inversion, as to the way in which we ourselves would want to justify that vital area. The Marxists were convinced that only through a Marxist philosophy could you have true human rights. A.P. Molchan, who was associate director of the Institute of State and Law in Moscow and the author of the first book-length treatise on human rights published in the Soviet Union, said the following, quote, "It is only with the emergence of the Soviet state that the principles concerning universal respect for the fundamental human rights really appeared and established itself," unquote. Now that's quite a claim. I knew Molchan personally when I was director of studies at the International Institute of Human Rights in Strasbourg, France. I invited Molchan to speak, and he was a fairly stiff and difficult fellow, so I thought the one way really to deal with him effectively was to take him out drinking. This works very well with Russians in general. And so I took him out to a small bistro, and I plied him with the wondrous Alsatian white wines. And when we got to about the third bottle, Molchan said, "John," he said, "I do not know what to do. My daughter is sleeping around in Moscow. Why aren't people maintaining the values they used to maintain?" And I said, "AP," I said, "Marxists don't hold to any absolute values. What you're seeing here is simply the logical outworking of your philosophy. Why are you surprised? The amazing thing is that everyone isn't out sleeping around." Well, Molchan, when he sobered up, of course, would not have any of it, but his viewpoint was that only through Marxism are you going to get a valid and sound philosophy of human rights. What is the Marxist philosophy of human rights? Well, that depends directly on the Marxist legal philosophy. And what's the Marxist legal philosophy? Why? That depends on the general Marxist worldview. You see, Marxism is an architectonic, consistent system where the fundamental philosophy impacts the legal position, and the legal position in turn impacts the human rights viewpoint. So in order to understand human rights in Marxism, we've got to understand the legal philosophy, and to understand the legal philosophy, we've got to understand the general philosophy. The general philosophy goes like this. At the root of it all is materialism. Marx held that material factors impact everything else, and it doesn't go the other way around. Material considerations are far more important than any other considerations. Marx did his doctorate on Democritus, the pre-Socratic materialist philosopher of the ancient Greeks, and Marx was convinced that material considerations determine everything. On this, he built the Hegelian dialectic. What's the Hegelian dialectic? Well, Hegel was an idealistic philosopher of the 19th century, and he held that one thing will produce its opposite, one idea for Hegel will produce its opposite, and the two of them will struggle together, and out of them will come a higher idea. And the higher idea will, in turn, produce its opposite, and there'll be a refinement, and you'll get an even higher idea. And the thing will keep moving onward and upward. Bigger bugs have littler bugs upon their backs to bite them, and littler bugs have littler bugs, and so ad infinitum. The thing will continue onward and upward to an idealistic goal of perfection. Well, as we've said, Marx was a materialist, so of course he didn't go with the ideological development of civilization. What he did, as he said, was to turn Hegel on his head. And he introduced material factors into this dialectic. One material consideration will produce its opposite in a struggle, a social struggle, and out of it will come a higher materialistic frame of reference, and that will produce an even higher one. And what are the factors that materialistically will achieve this? Well, they are primarily economic factors. For Marx, all the factors are equal, but some are more equal than others. Ha! And the most important of these factors materialistically are the economic factors. So economic struggles will determine history. Putting it in modern terms, those who own the means of production in society, the capitalists, will necessarily enter into a struggle with those who don't own the means of production, the proletariat. And class war will result, and out of this class war will come, first of all, a dictatorship of the proletariat, that is to say, a temporary political system where the proletariat will rule and extirpate the last vestiges of capitalism, and then ultimately the state and law will wither away and a millennial classless society will arise. Why will the proletariat win? Well, it's simple. The capitalists have become fat cats, and they are trying to hold on to everything that they have achieved, whereas the proletariat have nothing to lose. As Marx and Engels say at the end of the Communist Manifesto, workers of the world unite. You have nothing to lose but your chains. And so in this class struggle, the proletariat will win, capitalism will disappear, and the economic lion will lie down with the economic lamb, and all will be well. That is the fundamental Marxist philosophy, and it is an inevitable progress. It will occur no matter what. Some people have said that the difference between the Marxist and the non-Marxist in this theory is that both are on an escalator, and the escalator is moving ultimately to class war and the classless society. The Marxist is moving with the escalator, while the non-Marxist is sitting backwards on the steps, refusing to admit that the thing is moving forward. Out of this comes the Marxist legal philosophy. And what does that say? Well, it's based on a concept of superstructure and foundation, or base and superstructure. And what exactly does that mean? Well, according to the Marxist philosophy, there are certain aspects in society that are fundamental. They are the base, and other things are merely superstructure. Here is a statement of this from the Soviet Academy of Sciences in 1958. It's from a catechism of Soviet dogma. We quote, "The base of society contains the totality of the economic relations between men, which come to be in the course of material production. To the superstructure belong all social ideas and the institutions connected with them, state, justice, political parties, political ideas, morality, art, philosophy, religion, church, etc." Now, notice that carefully. The base is economic and material, and the superstructure ideological. Everything else is part of the superstructure. That means state, justice, law are part of the superstructure. Material factors, then, influence the law. They influence anything which is ideological in the society, and it doesn't go the other way. So the law is never fundamental in Marxism. The law is something that results from the economic conditions. The early Marxist legal theorists argued that because the state is on the verge of disappearing anyway, law is on the way out, and therefore it is only a temporary phenomenon. This worked very well until Stalin, but Stalin didn't really like the idea of the state disappearing, because Stalin was a bit like Louis XIV, l'état c'est moi, the state is I. Stalin wanted increased statism, not reduced statism. So, conveniently, Marxist legal theorists moved in that direction, and they said, well, law is not just something that's going to disappear. Law is a tool for social steering. We will use the law in order to further the interests of Marxism. Another characteristic of Marxist legal theory is that the end justifies the means. The end justifies the means. That is to say, you use the law where it will help the growth of Marxism, but you don't use the law necessarily if it doesn't have that kind of effect. One of the great Marxist theorists of the law was Lukács. He was a Hungarian Marxist, and Lukács's view on this is very interesting. It comes from his work, History and Class Consciousness. This is what Lukács says. Where the total communist fearlessness with regard to the state and law is present, the law and its calculable consequences are of no greater importance than any other external fact of life with which it is necessary to reckon when deciding upon any definite course of action. The risk of breaking the law should not be regarded any differently than the risk of missing a train connection when on an important journey. Unquote. After all, if you're taking the train, that's just a means to an end, right? The idea is to get to the place you want to go. And if the train isn't the best way to get there, why you use some other means of transport? Says Lukács, the idea is to reach the classless society. And if the law will help you to get there, great. But if the law won't, you don't have to worry about it. In other words, in a Marxist frame of reference, there isn't any rule of law that stands over everybody. The law is a means to an end. It isn't fundamental in the society. It is derivative. It is part of the superstructure. Well then, where does that take us as far as human rights in Marxist theory? It follows from all of this that human rights will depend necessarily on social and economic factors. Human rights will not have any absolute or independent character. They couldn't. And it also follows from this as to why Mobshan and other Marxists have claimed that you only get true human rights in a Marxist context. Because only in a Marxist context you have a proper socioeconomic frame of reference. So it's got to follow logically that the Marxists have the human rights and other people have a much more primitive understanding of that sort of thing. Another characteristic of the Marxist philosophy of human rights is that private property will, of course, be detrimental to human rights per se. Private property is not something neutral. Private property is something that takes away from a proper human rights understanding. So you've got to get rid of private property if you want to maximize human rights. Marxist theorists argue that inalienable rights can be used as an expression, but in point of fact, you're not going to have anything that is truly inalienable. Socioeconomic conditions change, and so human rights will change as well. This is what Dr. Kartoshkin had to say on the subject. The socialist concept of human rights, says he, does not reject the idea of inalienable natural human and citizens' rights, But the Marxist-Leninist theory deduces human rights not from the nature of man, but from the position of an individual in the society, and above all, the process of public production. It proceeds from the premise that social opportunities and rights are not inherent in the nature of man and do not constitute some sort of natural attributes. Rights and freedoms of individuals in any state are materially stipulated and depend on socioeconomic, political, and other conditions of the development of society, its achievements, and progress, unquote. Well, if human rights are conditioned by socioeconomic, political, and other factors, then obviously you can't have absolute rights. The rights will vary according to the socioeconomic conditions, and that follows logically from the basic principles of Marxism. Marxists have held that the individual is not a proper subject of international law. This goes back to 19th century theory, where only states were subjected to international law, but the Marxist has a particular reason for taking that view. Marxists, you know, think collectively, and so the one thing they don't want is to have individuals screaming that their human rights are being violated. So if the individual is not a subject of international law, the individual cannot make complaints to international human rights bodies, and things are much calmer within a Marxist frame of reference. Another illustration of that kind of approach comes from the Marxist human rights notion that of the sometimes called the non-interference principle. The idea there is that one country should not interfere in the political activities of another. This is an absolute notion of national sovereignty. That means that one country should not criticize another country's human rights record. Mm-hmm. This was used selectively, by the way, in the days of the USSR. USSR screamed, for example, whenever there was a criticism of what they were doing in Afghanistan. On the other hand, they had no trouble criticizing the United States for getting involved in Vietnam. A certain inconsistency there, but the fundamental principle was non-interference. According to the Marxist human rights theory, you're only going to get human rights when you get a Marxist economic political system established. Thus, in the West, what you have is law being used to keep the lid on the garbage can of capitalism. People think that we have civil liberties, but really we don't. What we have, unfortunately, is nothing but repression of those who do not have control of the means of production in society. Well, what do we have to say about this viewpoint? To critique a monolithic viewpoint like this, of course, it's necessary to deal with it systematically. And very briefly, we'll do that. Materialism and the economic approach to history. Are these necessary? Well, certainly not. Of course, economic and material factors do have a powerful influence in history. You can show that the shift in the commerce in the Mediterranean at the end of the Middle Ages had a great deal to do with the rise of the Italian Renaissance. But it doesn't follow that ideas can't have a similar influence on history. Material things influence ideas, but ideas influence material things. Goodness, Eli Whitney's invention of the cotton gin, that idea had tremendous economic consequences. And ironically, Marx's economic theory, his ideology, has had great impact on economics. It eventually brought about the economic collapse of the Soviet Union. So we can't say that things always go in one direction. It isn't a monolithic, unitary movement from material to idea. It goes in many directions. But if that's the case, then it's impossible to justify this entire Marxist theory. There's no reason why there would have to be a class war. You know, Marx operated early in the 19th century, and it didn't occur to him that there are other ways of solving the problem of capital labor than class war. You can, for example, form labor unions. You can get labor unions so powerful that the capitalists are running scared. And you can have government through antitrust move into the picture, thereby preventing the capitalist from grinding down on the proletariat. Class war doesn't turn out to be inevitable, and indeed, no classless society ever arose under Marxism. You never had this. It was an utterly millennial utopian idea. The unfortunate thing about the Marxist legal philosophy is that it doesn't maintain an absolute rule of law. And the notion that the end justifies the means is a very, very fundamental mistake. Indeed, it's one of the most fundamental ethical mistakes that can be made. The reason why it's a mistake is that the means you use will form and create the end itself. The means can modify the end. You know that famous film concerning Huey Long and his corrupt political regime in Louisiana. In that film where Broderick Crawford received an Academy Award, Huey begins as an idealist, but he's willing to use corrupt means, and eventually this corrupts the end that he is going to achieve. This happened again and again within Marxism. And Marxist human rights theory is unfortunately only that, a theory. It never did arrive at the point where it achieved what it was supposed to. Human rights in the Soviet Union were minimal, and human rights do not solely depend upon socio and economic conditions. Human rights depend ultimately on the values that the society maintains, and particularly whether or not there is an absolute concept of human rights, inalienable rights, that are not simply the product of the social development in the society. Jesus once said that it isn't what goes into a man that corrupts him, it's what comes out of him. That is to say, it's what's inside of people that establishes their attitude toward rights and values and ethics. And the problem with Marxism basically was that Marxism insisted that you could alter the fundamental nature of people by altering the external socioeconomic conditions under which they live. You know, that's never proven itself. When liberals in Western society tore down slums and built lovely buildings, and the same people went back into those new buildings, they quickly brought those buildings down to the condition of the slums. You've got to have people change inside before they're going to be able to influence things outside. It doesn't work the other way around. Marxism tried to move from the outside, from the socioeconomic externals, to the heart of man. That isn't the way it works. Human rights have got to start inside and move outside.